Okay, so when I titled it, I gave it the title Bilaam's Third Symphony. One of my pet peeves with this parsha is that it's a beautiful, beautiful parsha. Everyone says it's a beautiful parsha, and no one actually learns it. Meaning, we all know Bilaam tries to curse the Jews, and he's saying these beautiful songs and beautiful praises, but how many people actually read what he said? If pressed, people can say, well, I know Matovu is in there. And they think that all of Matovu was in there, when of course it's not. It's just the opening pasuk. So I wanted to look at his third bracha specifically, which is the one that put Balak, king of Moab, over the top, made him say, "Okay, that's it. I can't have you continue to try to curse the Jews." What was it about this song that so irked Moab? So before we get into the bracha itself, we need to know what it was that motivated Moab to hire Bilaam in the first place. The usual line of thinking is that Balak, king of Moab, hired by Moab and Midian because the Jews are coming through and they're worried that the Jews are going to go to war against them, right? That's the usual line. But if you actually read the psukim, that's not what the psukim say. If you take a look at source number 2, you find what they actually said. Balak ben Zippor saw that what the Jews had done to the Amori, specifically fighting them in battle and demolishing them. Moab was very scared of this nation because there were so many, or because they were so mighty. And Moab was disgusted before the children of Israel. That's your first sign that this is not a simple story. Vayakatz Moav. Right? The same verb is used regarding Mitzrayim. When the Jews reproduce in Mitzrayim, right? Haru vayishritzu vayirbu vayasmu b'ma'od me'od. At that point, we find Vayakutsu mipnei b'nei Yisrael. It's the same language that Mitzrayim uses with the Jews. With the Jews becoming many, with the Jews multiplying. So that's a tip in terms of understanding where this is going. Vayomer Moav al Zeknei Midian. Moav says to the elders of Midian, the group, this nation, is going to link up all of our surroundings. Rashi makes the point there that it's like it's on the next line really. Kilachol hashor es yerek hasadeh, like an ox consuming all the greens of the field. He says the idea is that nothing is left behind. And Balak ben Zippor was the king of Moab at that time. Based on this line here, based on what Moab says to the elders of Midian, what actually is their concern? What is their concern? Right. It's a property issue. They're concerned about resources. Moab is not worried about fighting a war against the Jews. Perhaps Moab knows, I don't know, that Hashem instructs the Jews, don't go to war against Moab. Hashem actually said, Al tatzaras Moab, al tisgar b'melchama, I've given B'nai Lot certain areas, and don't mess with them. Maybe they're already aware of that, I don't know. Or maybe it's because they know the Jews are really headed for Canaan. The Jews go to war against Sichon, because Sichon comes out with an army. It could be that Moab knows, we have nothing to worry about from the Jews militarily. The concern is, there are an awful lot of these Jews. And they're going to come through this area, and they're going to eat everything we have. Moab doesn't know how to share. That's the fundamental problem. Where do I get this from? Where does Moab come from? What's Moab's origin? Right. From Lot. Right? Lot and his daughter, right? Ammon and Moab emerged from Lot and his daughter after the destruction of Sodom. Source number 1, please. Mishnah and Pirkei Avos. Ha'omer shali shali v'shalcha shalcha. If someone says, what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours, harezo mida benonis, that's intermediate, right? I'm not taking from other people, I'm just not generous. V'yesh omer mzumidas Sodom. And some say this is the trade of Sodom. In fact, something we find reiterated in the Gemara when they talk about kofin al midas Sodom, forcing people to not act like Sodom. Forcing people to not act like Sodom means forcing people to behave nicely to others. If there's a transaction you're involved in which the other party can gain and you won't lose anything, then we compel you to be nice to the other people. That's an oversimplification of Midas Sodom, but that's basically the Gemara's application of the term. The idea is that Sodom, they're not thieves, they're not aggressive, they are defending what's theirs. And Moab, a product of the destruction of Sodom, has the same trait. As a matter of fact, we find it later in the Torah, you can see it in source number 3, Elimelech, right? Remember the story from Rus? Elimelech leads his family away because there's a famine, and Elimelech says, I don't want everybody to come to me. You can see it there, the Medrash in Rus Rabbah, source number 3. I gave you a translation of part of it there in the English. The Elimelech's claim is, it is a famine out, people are going to come to me, they're going to expect me to spend my money for them. And so he runs away. Where does he run to? Moab. Right? He's going to people who believe what he believes. It's selfishness. Source number 4, when we're told that a Moabite should not marry into Klal Yisrael, lo yavo Amoni u'Moavi bekal Hashem, the Amoni and Moavi are not allowed to marry in, gam dor asiri lo yavo lem bekal Hashem ad olam, even the 10th generation, al devara shelo kidmu eschem balechem uvamayim baderach b'tischem in Mitzrayim. They didn't offer you bread and water. And by the way, Asher Zachar Alach has Bilam Ben Bor. There's also that Bilam thing. They happen to hire Bilam to curse you. The first point being the Iker, generally. That's usually the essence. And the second point is an additional point. The main point is they didn't welcome you to the area. Now, there are a lot of other parallels, just parenthetically, between the story of Bilam and the story of Sodom and the origins of Moab. There's a lot more that you could do with this. But focusing on the point at hand, the point is that what really motivates Moab here is not wanting to share their resources with this nation that's coming through the area. And so they hire Balaam, I should say. They're not ready to go to war. They hire somebody and say, listen, if you curse them, maybe they'll be reduced and then they won't be able to make such an impact on our area. That's the idea. Which brings us to Bilam's third symphony, source number 5, his third attempt to curse the Jews, and what he actually says. Vayar Bilam, kito b'nei Hashem levareches Yisrael. Bilam sees that it's good in Hashem's eyes to bless Israel, right? The first two times it came out as a bracha, as indeed Hashem had told him, you're only going to say what I tell you to say. V'olach kifam b'fam l'kras nechashim. He didn't bother trying to engage in sorcery. Vayashas el hamidbar panav, and he turned his face to the wilderness, where the Jews are camped. Vayisa Bilam es einav, he raised his eyes. Vayaris Yisrael shochen l'shvatav, he saw the Jews dwelling by their shvatim, by their tribes. Vatehi olav ruach elokim, and he is inspired by Hashem. This is unique here. The Rashbam makes the point here as well. He is inspired by Hashem. Vayisa mishalo, he begins his parable. Vayomar, and he said, Ne'um Bilam beno Ba'or, the word of Bilam, son of Ba'or, Ne'um agever shesum ha'ayim, the word of the man of the closed or opened eye. There's a debate about how to translate shesum, whether that comes from sasum, something that is sealed, or whether it means pierced, that his eye is open. There's some debate as to what Bilam is trying to express there. Ne'um shomea imre kel, the word of the one who hears the statements of God, asher machazei shakai yechazeh, who sees the visions of God, nofel uguye na'im, who falls down and his eyes are open, a reference to going into some kind of a trance. The Medrash picks up on that and notes that's the difference between Bilam and Moshe, one of three differences between Bilam and Moshe, where Moshe has a greater power than Bilam, is that Bilam is not able to stand when Hashem speaks to him. His body can't take it. Whereas Moshe stands upright when he talks to Hashem. There are three ways in which Bilam has superior power and three ways in which he has inferior power. Okay, so that's the introduction. Now we get the song itself. Classic line, Matovu o'alecha Yaakov, Mishkanosecha Yisrael. How good are your tents, Yaakov? How great are your dwellings? We'll translate Mishkan as dwellings for now, Israel. Kinechalim nitayu, keganos alei nahar. They are extended like streams. They're like gardens by a river. Ka'aholim nota Hashem, like aloe. Ohel here is aloe, not a tent. The Ka'aholim nota Hashem, like aloe planted by God. Ka'arazim alei mayim, like cedars upon the water. Yizal mayim midolyo v'zaro b'mayim rabim. Water spills from his pail or flows from his pail, and it seeds in great waters, in many waters. Ve'arom me'agag malko, his king will be mightier than Agag. V'tinasei malchuso, and his monarchy or his throne will be elevated. Kel motzio mi'mitzrayim k'sofos re'eim lo, the God who removed him from Egypt, like the elevated horns of the Re'im. The Re'im is described in Psukim as being some mighty beast. The Gemara talks about it as being some kind of a very large animal. Yochal goyim tsarav, he consumes the nations who are his enemies. Vasmosayhem yegareim, he either crushes or drags, depending on your translation, the bones of the enemy. Vechitzav yimchatz, and either that means he will shoot his arrows into the enemy, or he will break the enemy's arrows. Two different approaches there. Kara shachav ka'ari uchalavi miyikimenu, he kneels and lies down like a lioness who will rouse him. Mivarachecha baruch va'orecha arur, those who bless you are blessed, those who curse you are cursed. That is Bilam's third symphony. It sounds pretty, and it gets Balak so angry that Balak says, forget it, just go home. Now, Balak didn't play baseball. Okay? So therefore, I don't know why the third time, specifically, is when he says to Bilam, you're out. Why didn't he get angry after the first one? Or after the second one? There is a principle within halacha of chazaka, that once you do things a few times, that shows a pattern. But even within halacha, there's a debate as to whether that's after twice or after three times. I don't think it's the number that so irritates him, as much as it's the content. There's something here within this song that says to Balak, forget it, this ain't working. I have to get rid of this guy. If anything, what he's doing here is gonna be horrible for me and make things worse. So various Mefarshim try to explain this as a coherent whole. Rashi says it's spiritual praise for the Jewish camp. So like he talks about, based on the Medrash, he's praising the tents of Israel because the entrances aren't opposite each other. It's like Thornhill construction, right? Right? You have the windows on one wall, the other side has no windows there and all that. The you know, about on the zero line construction.
Look into your neighbors.
Not right, us. You can't look into the neighbor's property. Sorry?
Not us, we can see straight in.
Well, you have to do something
on
about
both
that.
Sides of your house?
Theater is an exception.
Well, yeah,
theater
do something about that.
A lot of it were built,
right,
defying the laws purposely.
Okay. Well, Bilam wouldn't praise your house, that's all. at least according to Rashi.
Another reason we don't look up.
Rashi is motivated to say that this is on a spiritual level simply because the bracha doesn't make sense. There's no water. The Jews are in the wilderness. Where are they getting their water from? From a rock, right? We had that discussion last week. So the Medrash has to say, this is metaphor. This isn't real. You find in some of the Targumim indications that it's actually about the land of Israel. Praise for the land into which they're entering. The Rashi doesn't go that route. Malbim suggests it's about the success of today leading to success of the future. So Matovu Ohalecha Yaakov, an Ohel is more transitory. A Mishkan is more permanent. The idea of being Shachin, of actually being resident. So today you're an Ohel. Tomorrow will be a Mishkan. Today you're Yaakov. Tomorrow you're Yisrael, the name of destiny and power. Today you're a Nachal, a stream. Streams dry up from time to time. Tomorrow you'll be a Nahar, a river that doesn't dry up. Right? Unless it's the Arden. But today you are fragrant grass, aloe, which ultimately shrivels and dies. Tomorrow, you're a cedar tree, right? Which is mighty and which endures. Today, it's water that you're drawing in your pail. Water flows from the pail in Pasuk Zion there. Tomorrow, though, Zaro b'mayim rabim, it'll be flowing rivers. Today is Shaul battling Agag. Tomorrow is the monarchy of David HaMelech and the end of any need for war, breaking the arrows and all that. So that's the way Malbim sees it, which is beautiful in its own right. But what I want to look at in particular is the Netziv. The Nitziv here is incredible. He says many things that have nothing to do with this, which are also great, that that really make this a worthwhile read. And it also shows what it is that has Balak so aggravated. Nitziv sees it as about the present and future personal and national success of the Jewish people. So in other words, there are four elements. There is what's going on right now on the personal level. There's what's going on right now on the national level, and then there's also the projection of that into the future. He goes pasuk by pasuk, and I translated for you here. I didn't bring the Hebrew, usually I like to, because no one has the Nitziv typed out online. It's just not there. The Nitziv on Shmos has been scanned in, but nothing else has, and I wasn't going to sit there and retype all of that and do the translation. So I apologize, but take a look at a Nitziv, and you'll be able to see the original. It's very worthwhile, particularly because I didn't translate some of his more challenging lines in terms of political correctness. He has a couple of things that he says there that I just didn't translate because I didn't want it on a sheet floating around. So go look at the original, and you'll see what I'm talking about. He says, Matovu ohalecha Yaakov mishkanosecha Yisrael. So he catches the plurals. Ohalecha is tense, plural. Mishkanot, right, is the plural of Mishkan. And he says, first of all, Matovu ohalecha Yaakov, you see it at the bottom of the first side. He says that it refers to two tents of the masses of Yaakov, the tents of women and the tents of men. Not so much saying that there were men's tents and there were women's tents, that's not his point. But that men and women function separately in the Ohel, and each one gets its own praise. That's the idea. What is the difference? Take a look on the top of the flip side. He also says, Mishkanosecha Yisrael. You know what? I didn't bring you the translation, so actually I'll have to say it. I forgot I didn't bring that. He says, the tents of the men refers to the places, well, the tents of the women, because that's the one he does first, refers to the places where they practice chesed. The Gemara points out that if a man gives to a pauper, he tends to give him cash. The pauper comes to the house, though. The woman is there. She has the baby at home or whatever, and therefore she's sitting at home. Don't talk to me about nannies and daycare and all those other things. So she's home, and she has food in the house, and therefore when the pauper comes to the house, she can actually give him something to eat. And that's considered a higher form of chesed. So he says that's the emphasis there in the ohel of the nashim, of the women, is the chesed that they do. And for the man, the ohel of the men, is the idea of the study of Torah, performance of mitzvos, that the man does in the course of his day. Yes, it's true, women learn Torah. Yes, it's true, women do mitzvos. Nonetheless, the greater emphasis in terms of the obligation for, number one, certain mitzvos from which women are exempt, and number two, spending one's free time learning Torah, the greater emphasis is, classically, on the man doing so. So that's his starting point, is ohel. Mishkanot, he says, take a look at the top of the second side. Mishkan is the gathering of councils, okay, meaning community leaders, in two ways. There are gatherings of councils for communal needs in the matters of the world, right, Tzarchei Tzibur, and there are gatherings of leaders of Israel for the sake of Torah, learning Torah, practicing Torah. That's the religious leadership. So he says, again, these are two different brands of gatherings. There are those who gather for the sake of taking care of communal needs, and that's its own merit. And there are those who gather for the sake of spreading Torah, and that's its own merit. And now he takes this set of four, the women's tents, the men's tents, the political leadership, and the religious leadership, and translates that into the rest of the bracha. He says, Kinchalim nitayu. Okay, like a stream, they extend forward. He says, that's the women's tent. That's what it's talking about. Why? So take a look at what I have there on the sheet, the second paragraph on the second side. He stated the parable, they are extended like streams regarding the tents of women. It is known that women benefit paupers more directly, right, like we had just said, with tzedakah and kindness that are compared to a flooding stream. Tzedakah flows, providing benefit to others, and so it is like a stream. Now, he has to tie it in back to Hashem, because the pasuk says, that this is what Hashem provides. Ahalim nata Hashem is a reference as he understands it in general to the pasuk. So he says the choicest of the kindnesses of the women of Israel is when they bring others to Torah and service of Hashem. And he looks back at the fact that it's called a nachal, a stream. A stream, theoretically, can be a mayim, a product of a spring, which then you can dip things in for purification purposes. Right? A mayim can be like a mikvah for certain purposes, and even stronger than a mikvah for certain things. If you remember the Torah's discussion of the zav, the zav is a person with certain kinds of discharge. The zav goes to mikvah, so to speak, in a mayim, in a spring. We use water from a spring for the para aduma. You can't use mikvah water. It's no good. You can use mayim, depending a little bit on construction, you can use the mayim on a spring for tovel and kalim. So he says that's part of the reference to a nachal here. Like a mikvah of purification, bringing the Jewish people to sanctity. That's what their chesed is like. When it brings people to Torah and to service of Hashem. This is why the well was given in Miriam's merit, and the well left when she died. It's that purification that she provides. Like a stream, and then he continues to say, he now is going to go back on himself and say, well, you know what? Women may provide chesed, but not all women help people also come to Torah. So he says, that's okay, it's still a nachal. He says, a stream also may not be kosher as a mikvah, so to speak. I use the term mikvah really inappropriately. Mikvah is a technical term not referring to a stream at all, but to standing water. So what I mean is body of purification. He used the term wrong also, so I'm not, so bad for using it. He says, like a stream, even if it is not qualified for immersion, because it lacks 40 sa'ah, the amount of water you need for it to be kosher, or because it is zochalin, which is a term to the way the river flows, that will disqualify it from serving for purification. You need to make sure you have a certain quantity of water in one area. Not just that, the water that flows through eventually accumulates to that amount. Many people still benefit from it. Still, it's better if the stream leads to a spring or to a great river to complete its kashrut, meaning that it leads to sanctity. So the deeds of women in helping a person, even if they are not specifically dedicated to its sanctity, are still good like a stream of tzedakah. So in other words, he says the comparison of the tents of the women to a stream is that it provides water for people, and they can even have a higher level of bringing purification. That's what he says regarding the tent of Yaakov. Then on the other hand, he says you have the tent of the men, which he talked about as the tent in which they gather to learn Torah. Kiganos alei nahar. Like a garden upon the river. Actually, it's not about gathering. It's a tent where he learns Torah. The gathering is coming next. So he says something here which is fascinating. You hear people say this all the time, but people rarely quote the source for it. He says, this is a parable regarding the tents of the men of Yaakov. That which grows in a garden, he says, we're compared to a garden, right? A garden upon a river. So he says, that which grows in a garden is not like that which grows in a field. A field is planted with only one or two varieties, of a field of wheat, of cotton, whatever it is, as opposed to gardens which have many kinds of seeds, comparing it to many kinds of mitzvahs. Still, each garden has one central variety. The Netziv School of Gardening in Volozhin, they have one central variety in a garden. It happens to be true in terms of garden design. For anyone who's looked at garden design, for aesthetic purposes, you want to have a certain dominant thing, unless you want just like one of these wildflower type setups where just anything goes. This is a philosophy of garden design. Each garden has one central variety, and it's only that small quantities of other varieties are planted around it for effect, to play off the colors. So too, each Jew is filled with the mitzvah of Hashem. But each one has one special mitzvah in which he is extra careful. As is seen, he quotes in the Mechilta, one who performs a single mitzvah faithfully is worthy of divine inspiration, Ruach HaKodesh. And Yerushalmi in Kiddushin explains regarding the Mishnah. Mishnah says, at the end of the first parak in Kiddushin, one who performs a single mitzvah receives goodness. The Yerushalmi explains, this refers to performing a mitzvah with exceptional care. So he says, the man is compared to a garden in the sense that he has something in which he is an expert. He says, this is my main mitzvah. And then he has the other mitzvahs around it. I thought that was very telling. Yeah, I've heard this idea before. You should take one mitzvah and do it really, really well. So he's giving you sources for it here. He also goes on to talk about the river theme and the idea that it's something that will grow and have a continual source of water. It continues to be renewed. So Bilam has now established the tents of the men and the women and praised them. And then he continues to talk about the communal gatherings. Ke'aholim nata Hashem, like aloe planted by Hashem. This is another one which is fascinating, the way he says this. He says, this is talking about the communal councils, when people gather in order to provide for the needs of the community. This is a parable for the Mishkan, not Mishkan meaning the Mishkan where you bring karbanos, but a parable for the Mishkan of those who are summoned by the nation of Hashem to handle communal needs and matters of generosity, chesed. We have already explained that acts of kindness are compared to spices. He already explained that, I just didn't bring it on the sheet. The acts of kindness are compared to spices, like the aloe that he's talking about here, something that smells nice, he means. And we have explained that even those who are sent on a path of wildness, meaning people who don't follow the mitzvahs, are still an orchard of pomegranates filled with mitzvot like pomegranates because of the chesed that they do. A Jew who's not davening, who's not keeping kosher, who's not learning Torah, nonetheless may well have a great many mitzvahs because he does good things for other people because of the chesed element. That's what he's saying here. And his reference to the pomegranates, we know, right? Malay mitzvos karimon, filled with mitzvos, like a pomegranate is filled with seeds. Forget the 613, we've talked about that on other occasions. There are no 613 seeds. This is not like the mitzvot of the Torah, he says, which are compared to oil. Because oil has no scent of its own, but only absorbs scent from its environment. While spices are not so, but have the same scent regardless of who bears them. Do you see what he's saying? He says, if you teach Torah to somebody, we talked about this when we did Pirkei Avos. We said you're not supposed to teach Torah to someone who's going to use it inappropriately, right? Someone who has bad behavior. He says Torah is like oil. Oil, he says, I haven't studied this, but oil doesn't have a good scent of its own. What it does is it will amplify the scent of whatever it's on. So Torah is compared to, is that true? I mean, people say this?
You make candles out of oil. No, you make infused oil, like you would put herbs into oil to make.
Oh, that's a good point.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's
okay.
Vegetable on its own has no scent.
Ah, okay, good. We have confirmation then. So he says,
women.
He says, there you go. He says, Torah is compared to oil. We find that frequently in the Torah. And the idea is that Torah will amplify the scent of whoever has it, but isn't going to make it good. If you give Torah to somebody who is rotten, then it'll just have a really bad smell. It amplifies what's already inside. We've talked about that also on other occasions. That has applications elsewhere too. Whereas chesed is like a spice that has a good smell to it, and it can make anybody smell good. So that's his point. Saying ka'ahalim nata Hashem is a reference to communal gatherings for the sake of chesed, for the sake of looking after the needs of the community. Even if these are people who are not people of mitzvos, nonetheless, the chesed that they do gives them a good smell, like aloe. So too, the non-chesed mitzvot of Hashem involve no human logic, such that a person will affect them with his own mind. When you're dealing with the mitzvot of Hashem, I'm not sure what I translated as effect. I should have brought in a tziv. Effect I usually would have used for lashbia, but I don't see why that's relevant here. Okay, so I don't know what I was translating there. And only Israel who is instructed in this will be well spiced with them, with the mitzvos of the Torah that are not about chesed. It's only us who are practicing the mitzvos, so then the oil of these mitzvos will be good. But when an idolater performs them, then they lack any taste or scent. But acts of kindness are pleasant for all. This is why those who involve themselves in communal needs are compared to aloe. However, there is generosity in the nations of the world, and people understand that. But Jews uniquely practice generosity in the name of Hashem, and what he's picking up on is ka'ahalim nata Hashem, like aloe planted by God. When we do chesed, it's not supposed to be just, I want to do good things for people, but rather, I'm doing it as part of what Hashem has instructed me to do. I shouldn't look at it as a product of my own initiative, because that takes away from the religious component. It still has it, but it reduces it. And then the last part of that pasuk, ka'arazim alemayim, like cedars upon the water, he says that refers to the religious councils of the Jewish people. And he says, this is a parable for the second Mishkan of Mishkanotecha, the gathering for Torah and testimony, meaning testimony to Hashem. And nothing is higher than that. From there, prophets and all possible leaders of Israel are created. So he says it's like a cedar upon the water. Now, why a cedar? Well, for one thing, the Beis HaMikdash is called the Arzei HaLevanon, the cedars of Lebanon, because it's built with Arzei HaLevanon. Talmidei Chacham are called Arzei HaLevanon as well. It's in the piyut that we say on Tisha B'Av, the Kinah we say on Tisha B'Av, Arzei HaLevanon, talking about the death of the Asara Arugei Malchus, right? Ela Ezker on Yom Kippur, and Arzei HaLevanon on Tisha B'Av, or vice versa. I'm wondering if I'm actually confusing the two. But the reference here is to cedar trees, and cedar trees in particular, not just in terms of the Beis HaMikdash, but in terms of the person who studies Torah. He says the Torah already compares people to trees. Right? Ki ha'adam etz ha'sadeh, right? In Parsha Shoftim. But there are four kinds of trees. One is the thorn, which no one will take, for it is useless. It was created only to harm others. These are the wicked. The second is the bramble, and people take shelter beneath its branches and leaves. Even though you don't want to touch it, it'll still protect you. It's not a low thorn, it's a higher shrub of some kind. These are people who engage in the way of the world. So they do provide for others. And the third is the fruit tree. Like people who perform mitzvot and are compared to a fruit, but people do not benefit from the body of the tree itself. Meaning someone who performs mitzvot without chesed, without the chesed and derech eretz component. The fourth is the cedar, for which people benefit from the body of the tree in construction. Right, you use the wood itself, right, like the giving tree. I hate that story. All right, in any case, people benefit from the body of the tree as well. You get the shelter of it, and you can use it. This is like the people of Torah. The person is purified in all of his travels and ways, even in his normal conversation. Some cedars are better for one person's construction, and some for a mast for a ship at sea. And so it supports thousands of people, right? The ship at sea supports people on the boat, as well as all the people who get the goods that it brings back. So there is a scholar who is good for those who are around him, near to him. And then there's a scholar who leads his world like the captain of a ship. So cedars have multiple functions. This is the meaning of like cedars upon the water, that we use them on the water, meaning the ship. So he says that's the religious council. That's the idea. So he has four different groups. That's the success of the nation today. That's what Bilam sees right now. And then he goes into the future. He says, Yizal mayim midolyo, vizaro b'mayim rabim. Water will flow from his pail and be seeded in great waters. He's giving a history here, according to the Nitziv, of what happens to the Jews from that moment until the time of Shaul HaMelech. So he says, water will flow from his pail, vizaro b'mayim rabim, and its seed will be in many waters. So he says, this is about the process of purification. He says, after Hashem showed him the praise of his children, of Hashem's children, he showed Bilam the praise of the generations, from the time they would enter Israel until the time of Mashiach, overall, who should come soon. He did not see the bad days. Bilam doesn't see destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, only the good days, in order to poke his eyes. Because why not? This was concluded with his fourth vision. Remember what happens. He has three visions. Balak kicks him out, and he says on his way out, wait, there's one more thing I have to tell you. And he gives him a fourth vision about the time of Mashiach. He spoke regarding the generation of the judges who had wars in which many Jews were exiled. This is the period of that pasuk we're talking about now. We know not, but today there are places where Jews have been found claiming they have been there since the days of Pilegish Begiva. Right, from Shoftim? So Nitziv is familiar in his own day of tribes in different places and people claiming that they're Jewish. And it's not new. It's been going on for hundreds of years that people, travelers, explorers, would find a group and say, hey, they seem Jewish to me. The question about the Jews in Ethiopia is hundreds and hundreds of years old. So he says, who knows if they might have been exiled when the enemy became mighty in the days of judging the judges, meaning Shoftim. what does this have to do with anything? He says, that's the reference to water flowing from the pail. It's the idea that the Jews have been exiled over time, and even were being exiled in the time before Shaul. It's not something that starts with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Jews already were going out among the nations. V'zar'o b'mayim rabim, and is seated in many waters. And here he says something that's very creative and very interesting. He says, you have to know a little bit about the way Tahara works, the way purification works, so I need to explain it before we see it inside. If I have water that has become tamei, how do I make that water tahor? Right, there was water in a room where there was a corpse or something like that. How do I make the water tahor? You can't pour it into the mikvah because then you can't drink it, right? So what do? So the answer is a process that is called hashaka. We also use the term zriya here. And the idea is that you take the water in a vessel and you link it to the water in the mikvah by letting there be some contact between the two waters. Once you've done that, they're considered to have merged, and now all the water is tahor. Similar to when a person actually uses a mikvah, there's the area that they dip in. That's not the area where the rainwater is stored. That's in the bore next to it, right? The two are linked through a hole, right? To link the two, the hole has to be a certain width. And the idea is, that's hashaka, and that's merging the two bodies of water, such that they're considered a single unit, and the water that the person is immersing in is also considered to be kosher mikvah water. That's the way it works, in a nutshell. So, he applies that here. He says, Bilam, look at the Nitzit, Bilam witnessed the good in this event, in the Jews going into exile, saying, water will flow from his pail and seed in many waters. This is a parable. If a pail filled with water touches great waters, that is called seeding, zeriah. This is why hashaka works, to purify water. Even though the water remains in the pail and they are not entirely nullified, but rather they are seeded and joined with the other water. In other words, when Jews go into exile, so it's like zeriah. It's a purification of the water that's out there through contact with our water. In this case, the ones in the pail are the kosher mikvah, and we're purifying those who are outside. And what he's building on is the Gemara itself, which says that we were exiled among the nations, Kadesh Yitosfu Aleihem Gerim, so that people would join the Jewish people. That's the goal, that positive goal of Galut. Galut not as punishment, but Galut as a purposeful move by Hashem in order to increase our influence among, you know, in the greater world. And that's what the Nitziv applies here. He says that's what Bilam is seeing, the success of the Jews as they spread. And the pasuk continues. I didn't bring you more translation here. I ran out of room. V'yarome Agag Malko, his king will be greater than Agag. That's Shaul defeating Agag and Amalek. Agag, parenthetically, according to Rashbam, is a generic term among Amalekites for king. Like Paro is in Egypt, like Abimelech is among the Plishtim. It isn't a person named Agag. Rashbam uses that because it's very problematic the way that Agag shows up in history and whether Bilam knew what Agag was when he said the word Agag here. Bilam won't know the king Agag was around in the time of Shaul. So Rashbam says Agag is a generic name. You can see it in the Rashbam on this pasuk. V'tina se malchuso, right? His king will overpower Agag, will be elevated over Agag, and then his monarchy will be lifted. So you could take that to mean elevated, like his monarchy will become great. However, Nitziv says it's not what it's saying. His monarchy will be lifted from him. Right? Remember Yosef? I remember Yosef, right? Yosef says, regarding the dreams of the butler and the baker, right? He says, Yisab Paro es Roshcha, right? Paro will raise up your head. So he says to the butler first, Yisab Paro es Roshcha v'hashivcha kanecha. Paro will raise your head and put you back in your position. And the baker hears that and thinks, great. And the baker asks him about his dream. And he says to the baker, Yisab Paro es Roshcha me'alecha. Paro is going to lift your head from off your shoulders. And he'll hang you. That's the statement to the baker. The idea of being no say something doesn't have to mean elevated in a good way. So v'tina se malchuso, Shaul's monarchy will be elevated, lifted from him, and given to David. And it's a reference in a positive sense to the creation of the monarchy of David HaMelech, which he then continues with in the next pasuk, Kel Motziomi Mitzrayim, Hashem took us out of Egypt, Kesafos Re'em Lo, like the mighty horns of the rain. Yochal goyim tsarav, he will consume his enemies, who are the nations who are his enemies, as opposed to a time of Mashiach when everybody comes under Hashem. This is only David's success in war against his enemies. Vasmosehem yigarei mechitzav yimchatz, destroying their might, as the Nitziv takes it, destroying their weapons, they can't rise again to do battle. And then the final pasuk there, you can go back to see it in source number 5. Therefore, they can lie down without concern that anybody is going to rouse them, both among those they have conquered and those they have not. Even those who would attack verbally will be destroyed. That's Bilam's nevuah, and we can now understand why this is so aggravating to Balak. Balak's whole fear was not a war against the Jews. His fear was the Jews are going to succeed and flourish and spread, and there's going to be nothing left for Moab. And that's exactly what Bilam has just foreseen. The Jews living, flourishing, chesed, Torah, under a mighty king, anybody who's his enemy gets crushed, the Jews have nothing to fear. That's exactly what Moab doesn't want to hear. And that's why, at this point, he says, all right, I've had enough with this guy, I better send him home before he says anything else. But that's the idea. All right? All right. Well.